Question, how do you fix Twitter? You got 140 characters, ready, go. Yeah, nobody else can do it either. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, the 27th of October. Glad you could be with us, everybody. We talk every now and then on this program about Twitter, a social media company, 140 characters, you know the basics. It's a quite useful tool, really, for news and information, political hype and hyperbole, both here and globally. It's also, despite all of that usefulness, a company that seems quite adrift, not sure what it's actually supposed to be. What we know as of today is that it's going to be smaller. Revenue is slowing. Layoffs are coming. About 350 people, 9% of the company. Efforts to sell itself have gone exactly nowhere. So now what? Gigi Douban gets us started.
Twitter has never had a problem getting its name out there. Even people who don't use it at least know what it is. Or they've seen that little blue bird at the bottom of a TV screen.
The challenge has always been getting people to think about why they should use Twitter on a regular basis.
Deborah Aho Williamson is an analyst with eMarketer. She says its appeal has always been as a sort of news service. Karen North teaches digital social media at USC. She says the key to the company's growth is going back to basics.
So they're pulling back to what is originally their core purpose and the reason that they are a destination for their particular audience.
So Twitter just today killed Vine, which let users upload 6-second videos. Twitter is also shooting for more ad revenue through live content like NFL games. John Byers teaches computer science at Boston University. He says all of this is part of a bigger strategy for Twitter.
I think they're trying to become more attractive to acquirers.
Byers says if a suitor sees that Twitter is going to add to its bottom line, and Twitter has already done the messy work of cutting jobs, that's a plus. Twitter also has launched things like the Trust and Safety Council to try to shut down bullying on its platform. That might keep more wholesome potential buyers from being scared away. I'm Gigi Douban for Marketplace.
Should you be so inclined, by the way, you can get me on Twitter at Kai Rizdahl, KAIRYSSDAL is what you got to type. All right, moving on. The market for PCs is cooling, to be charitable. Everybody who can afford a mobile phone has one. So today's news of the biggest deal ever in the semiconductor space is worth a mention here. Qualcomm is going to buy NXP for $39 billion. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein explains where that chip growth is going to come from.
When you drop $39 billion, you better hope you're getting something good. Analyst G. Dan Hutchinson with VLSI Research says, don't worry, Qualcomm is. NXP is considered a top, if not the top, semiconductor company working in the auto industry today.
The biggest market that everyone is focused on right now is automotive, because it's just exploding.
If you're in the microchip business, growth in PCs and smartphones is slowing down to 3-4%. The automotive piece of the chip business is almost double that.
They see the car as the ultimate mobile device, in the true sense of the word.
Mark Hung covers emerging trends in technology for Gartner. With all the technology getting stitched into vehicles these days, Hung says for chipmakers, cars are dollar signs rolling down the street.
How they interact with your cell phone, your home, even with places around them, like when you are passing by a gas station, all those things are going to be much more interactive.
Hung estimates the semiconductor industry is $300 to $400 billion a year. And while companies like Qualcomm and Texas Instruments duke it out to be the biggest supplier of chips to automakers, there's another major market for their products. Anand Srinivasan is with Bloomberg Intelligence.
Industrial Internet of Things specifically could be a very, very interesting market from a size, growth, and profitability perspective.
Big picture, Srinivasan says there's only so much growth in the space where people interact with technology, like you and a smartphone. But when it comes to things talking to other things, like a car talking to a stoplight, the opportunities for chipmakers look almost endless. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
I commend to your attention a piece in Bloomberg today, a remarkably candid behind-the-scenes look at the Trump campaign. All kinds of details in there, including descriptions of a voter database that could be worth $100 million that the Trump campaign owns outright. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has that slice of the story.
Every presidential campaign has a database of supporters, but the Trump campaign's treasure trove is
the richest, most up-to-date database in conservative politics.
That's Vincent Harris, CEO of Harris Media, a digital advertising firm that worked with Rand Paul's presidential campaign. Harris says Trump's database has names, addresses, even credit card information. And Harris says lots of these Trump supporters have never donated to Republicans before.
I think that his database is essentially priceless.
Trump could use the database to further his political agenda, even if he doesn't win the presidential election. Jordan Lieberman is with Audience Partners. He places digital political advertising. He says Trump could send out post-election emails to his supporters, for example,
telling them to oppose the new immigration bill that is supported by the Democratic Senate and Hillary Clinton.
Trump could also use his database outside of politics. Patrick Ruffini is with Echelon Insights, a Republican polling and analytics firm. He says there would be a ready-made audience for something like, say, Trump TV, a rare thing for a media startup.
And most people, when they do that, have trouble getting traction because they don't have a list of people to really contact about it, to tell about it. That's not the case here.
Or Trump could rent out his database to other Republican candidates, sit back, and watch the money roll in. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, sad. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you've watched enough or really any cable news in the past year or so, you're familiar with the term campaign surrogate. In fact, you probably know them by name by now. The people out on the campaign trail and on the TV speaking, stumping, and otherwise proxying for this candidate or that. But hey, it's a job, if not actually a living. Marketplace's Lewis Wallace has more.
Surrogates do the dirty work for candidates, speaking at rallies, going on TV.
He's an American. He's a guy that worked hard and did well for himself.
Wasn't just locker room banter.
I think you'll see a very presidential Donald Trump today meeting
Hillary.
With the president.
Hillary!
Sandra Fluke is a social justice lawyer who came to prominence after she testified before Congress about the Affordable Care Act. And Rush Limbaugh attacked her, calling her a prostitute. After that, Fluke was invited to go on the road constantly during the Obama 2012 campaign. Democrats loved her because she was a young law student and smart. And she says mostly it was fun, but there were awkward parts of it.
The college campuses were kind of funny because when you go there, you need to sort of act hip and interesting to young people. And I was just never that hip to begin with.
And of course, you don't get paid for this, just plane tickets and maybe a free hotel. Mark McKinnon is a former Republican strategist and now produces the Showtime documentary, The Circus.
It's a very stressful gig. And I'd say that, you know, on the presidential level, it requires a lot of experience and a lot of skill.
This isn't a job you interview for. Some of the best surrogates are current or former politicians. But campaigns also seize on non-politicians who somehow show they're great at taking heat, and surrogates who somehow embarrass the candidate.
They don't last very long. Those surrogates.
He recalls Carly Fiorina getting pulled from John McCain's surrogate team in 2008 after she badmouthed him and Sarah Palin. Kina Lipsitz, a political science professor at the City University of New York, says when surrogates are doing the job right, they accomplish three things.
They allow a candidate to be in many places at once.
Like right now, Hillary Clinton's campaign can send
Joe Biden, Michelle Obama, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Cory Booker to battleground states all in the same day while she's in another one.
Second of all, she says
they lent or can lend credibility to the campaign.
Donald Trump's children have been good for that, and family in general can make candidates seem more human, attest to their character. Or, she says,
they can just be attack dogs, and they can go out and say the things the candidates can't say.
Lest you think that last one's just an example of our politics gone awry, Lipsitz says surrogates as attack dogs have always been around, and
it actually used to be much, much dirtier.
because back before TV and the internet, presidential candidates depended almost entirely on surrogates to travel the country speaking for them. In the campaign of 1800, a surrogate for John Adams went around saying if Thomas Jefferson were elected, all women would be forced into prostitution and Bibles would burn in bonfires, which reminds Lipsitz of what she says is a bonus role surrogates may play.
They can do damage control.
Exhibit A, Jennifer Granholm speaking to Chris Matthews about Hillary Clinton's emails.
She says she didn't do anything wrong, so why should
she have corrected? Right, I mean, she says in retrospect, she didn't violate any laws. But
Exhibit B, Rudy Giuliani on Meet the Press with Chuck Todd about the Trump tapes.
Only you are out defending Donald Trump. Are you the only one in the campaign that was willing to publicly defend him?
Absolutely not. I was with
Tough Kelly job, but they did volunteer for it. I'm Lewis Wallace for Marketplace.
$8.4 billion. That is how much the National Retail Federation says we are going to spend this year on Halloween. That is obviously a whole lot of candy corn and costumes. And when it comes to those costumes, the Pokemons and the Batmans and the name brand characters, there is one company that's making a whole lot of money on what used to be a pretty simple kids' holiday. Claire Suddeth writes about said company for Bloomberg. Claire, good to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me about this company, Rubies, that apparently makes all these costumes.
Well, they have an adorable backstory. They're called Rubies Costume Company. They've been around since 1951, and they started out as a soda shop in Queens. A man named Ruben Beige, who is no longer with us, and his wife started it. Then he sort of discarded with the soda shop idea and just started selling costumes wholesale, although at the time he just sort of thought of it as, you know, selling it to people in Queens.
And it is now run by his kids, and you spoke to, I guess, one of the sons, Howard, right?
Yes. So Rubies is now the largest costume maker in the U.S. and the producer of about half of all Halloween costumes in the U.S.
So if I go to Target or Walmart or Amazon, odds are it came from Rubies.
Exactly. If you are dressing up as a character this year from a movie or TV show, it's a good chance that what you've bought comes from Rubies. If you're going as something generic like a witch, you know, there are tons of companies that do that.
Right, right. So, and that's the really interesting part of this thing, the whole character from TV or movies. They are so big, they are so influential, this company is, that they actually know what's going to happen in the next Star Wars movie?
Yeah, so this is one of my favorite things I learned when I talked to Howard. And no, he will not tell you, even if you plead, which
asking
I may have
for
done.
A friend, yeah, right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and, you know, they've sort of figured this out the hard way over the years. In 1999, when Episode 1 was coming out, they really thought that Darth Maul was going to be the breakout character.
Oh, is that the red and black one with the horns all over his head?
Yeah, exactly.
Of course he was not going to be the breakout character. Are you kidding
me? Well, he looks cool, and, yeah, you know, people like dressing up as Darth Vader, and so they thought, okay, this is going to be it.
Yeah.
So Rubies had planned him to be about, you know, 50% of their Star Wars costumes that year, and he only sold about a quarter.
Yeah.
So since then, Lucasfilm has worked with him much more closely, and so far Rubies has been able
He's
to keep everything
right, yeah.
always under wraps.
Changing the series here from Star Wars to Star Trek, Howard Beige is actually basically the guy who got us thinking about costumes in a sort of different way, right?
You remember in the 70s and 80s, I only have a vague recollection of this, but the Halloween costumes themselves weren't very good.
Right.
They were plastic bag type things with, you know, the Star Trek one was a Captain Kirk mask and then a bag essentially with a picture of Starship Enterprise on it.
Right.
And Howard loves Star Trek. So he went to Paramount and he pitched them on the idea of an adult replica Halloween costume. And they were sort of like, but what about the mask?
Yeah.
He's like, the people who dress up as a Star Trek character want to be themselves, but as Captain Kirk,
That's
so they don't need a mask.
Right? Isn't that brilliant?
Yeah.
I think
has created this costume culture that we have now. Rubies is also very big in the Comic-Con scene, cosplay.
Oh, makes sense, yeah.
They make a lot of high-end costumes as well as Halloween.
About masks, I have to ask you, because you wrote about it and because Howard makes a lot of money off this, about masks for the various presidential candidates, Trump and Clinton this year. There's a predictive quality to those sales, but this year Howard says it doesn't usually it doesn't hold up as it usually does.
Right. So Ruby's has seen a number of presidential elections now. And according to Howard, in the past, they can always predict the winner of the presidential election based on whose mask sells best. You know, no one really won as John Kerry or John McCain ever.
Which is kind of sad.
Yeah. But this year is different. This year, Donald Trump's mask is outselling Hillary's in an absolute landslide. But Howard thinks that the reason behind this is a little bit different, and it may not be predictive of the actual election because people are actually dressing up as Donald Trump, both to support him and to make fun of him. And on top of that, women rarely wear full masks for Halloween. So you would have to have men buying the Hillary mask and dressing up as Hillary, which most men maybe will come up with a different costume that they would rather do. So, you know, those things together, I think you can't predict the election based on Halloween anymore.
Claire Suddeth writes for Bloomberg Business Week. Her most recent piece is called How the World's Biggest Costume Maker Cracked Halloween. Claire, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Coming up.
You know, it rose to a glory that it hasn't seen in since really the middle of the 19th century.
Pirouettes and pas de deux, the Bolshoi Ballet, straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials off 29 points. Today, about a 10th percent, 18,169. The NASDAQ slipped 34 points, 6-tenths percent, 52.15. The S&P 500 dropped 6 points, 3-tenths percent, 21.33. We told you earlier about how Qualcomm, maker of chips for smartphones, is buying NXP Semiconductors, maker of chips for cars, for 39 billion simoleons. Qualcomm shares powered up 2.7%. NXP slowed down 0.4%. You remember 5 years ago, we were awash with those Groupon and Living Social deals, discounts galore? Yeah, today not so much. Groupon has announced it's buying Living Social, not saying how much for, only that it's a, quote, non-material amount, which is like peanuts, really. Didn't impress the market at all. Groupon shares got their own steep discount down a hefty 22%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Once the election is out of the way, Congress and the White House are going to have to do something about the federal budget. Something as in approving a way to pay for the government once the current authorization runs out on December the 9th. Disagreements over what to do about Zika blocked a comprehensive deal back at the end of September. It had taken 8 months for Congress to find $1 billion to fight the outbreak, a delay that led to the head of the Centers for Disease Control asking for a general pot of money to fight health emergencies, kind of like FEMA has its own pot of money to react to natural disasters. It makes sense, but in that way only Washington has. This one isn't as simple as it seems. Marketplace's Andy Euler has the story.
On first glance, it looks like the CDC's asking for a new way to fund health emergencies. Instead of having to ask Congress to allocate money after an outbreak happens, the CDC could just pull money from this brand new stash. And we'd call it something like, I don't know, the Public Health Emergency Fund. Wait, it already exists?
That particular fund was actually created by Congress in 1983.
That's Megan McHugh. She's an assistant professor of emergency medicine at Northwestern University. She says in 1983, Congress stocked the fund with a handsome $30 million. To put that into perspective,
President Obama requested $1.9 billion for Zika this year. So $30 million doesn't really get the effort off the ground at all.
And after the first year, Congress stopped allocating money to it. But McHugh says the CDC isn't just asking for money. It's asking to move power and authority out of the hands of Congress.
giving, you know, a lot more power to the Department of Health and Human Services and, you know, public health experts.
Money and politics, they never stray very far apart. Ciro Ugarte is director of the Pan American Health Organization's emergency programs. He's a doctor and knows about health emergencies, but he says doctors aren't the ones who should be in charge of this money.
It is not technical. It has to be somebody with the highest level of political, economic, and social vision to call the shots.
The good news, the CDC doesn't have to get Congress to create a new public health emergency fund. Bad news, it has to figure out a way to convince lawmakers to fund it. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
You don't have to be a big ballet fan to know Swan Lake or the Nutcracker. And if you know them, you probably also know the company that helped turn them into classics, Russia's Bolshoi Ballet. It's been around for 240 years through the good times in Russia and the Soviet Union and the bad. It's still a key ingredient as well in brand Russia. Simon Morrison's new book about the company and the theater it performs in is called Bolshoi Confidential. Simon, welcome to the program.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Without casting political aspersions, I imagine one of the great first challenges for this company was the rise of communism and the revolution in the early parts of the last century.
Absolutely. Although that was the period in time with the Bolsheviks and the communist upheaval after 1917, the capital of Russia was moved from St. Petersburg down to Moscow, and it was moved in a very kind of casual, secret way with basically Lenin and a few aides and guards taking the train down to Moscow and setting up shop. And after a decade, the theater, which Lenin and his aides initially wanted to close because there was simply no funding to keep it heated, you know, there were schools to heat and factories to start up, and why are you keeping this decadent space alive? But after a while, they decided to actually keep it going. And then they thought, actually, the art produced by this place could be useful to propagate communist ideas. Mm. And so although it suffered a great deal, it also became the center, the most powerful ideological tool for the Kremlin.
If I went to not Moscow and not Red Square, but, you know, some little town in the middle of nowhere, Russia. Mm-hmm. Are people going to know what I'm talking about when I talk about the Bolshoi?
Yeah. Well, first of all, its major productions, operas and ballets, are put on television all the time. And it's considered to be, in many respects, the pride of the nation. And after the collapse of communism, the company was in such disarray that there was, the first and only time, there was a strike. And I remember looking in the newspaper, I was actually in Russia at the time, it basically condemned the performers and said, there you go, go on strike, and the last pride of our country goes with it.
How did it manage that transition then? Because it is, again today, one of the preeminent cultural institutions in that country, but also in the world.
It suffered greatly. The theater is largely funded by the government. When oil revenues collapsed, the budget of the theater collapsed with it and went down with it. So it was in a terrible state, disrepair. I remember seeing performances after the end of the communist period in the 90s in which suddenly the singing was out of tune in the operas. But then with the revival of the economy, the budget increased and the theater under Medvedev underwent this very ambitious renovation. You know, it rose to a glory that it hasn't seen in since really the middle of the 19th century.
What then, just to get it to present day, what is the fate and fortune of the Bolshoi under President Putin and the way things are going in that country now?
It's an interesting question. Mr. Putin doesn't seem to have a great deal of interest in the fine arts. He's a sports person, and somebody has quipped in one of the reviews of the book I read that, you know, it's just let him wrestle bears. It's good, good for the ballet. But I would say that he has not exerted much control over the theater himself. But still the theater, because it is the state academic Bolshoi theater and because it is the symbol of the nation and is a diplomatic tool, what it performs and its repertoire is still to some degree monitored. They have to be careful about putting on works that might be implicitly critical of, say, the Russian Orthodox Church or the government. And so patriotic fare is all important.
Simon Morrison is a professor of music at Princeton University. His book about the Bolshoi, the theater and the ballet and the company writ large, is called Bolshoi Confidential. Simon, thanks very much.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, in which if when you first heard about AT&T buying Time Warner, you said, so AT&T's buying Time Warner Cable, what's the big deal? Well, the Senate Judiciary Committee feels your pain. Today, the four top lawmakers on that committee sent an announcement about their upcoming hearing into the deal that said, quote, both Randall Stephenson, the CEO of AT&T, and Robert Marcus, the CEO of Time Warner, will testify, end of quote. Yeah, you know where this is going. Marcus runs Time Warner Cable, which was spun off 7 years ago. Jeff Bukas, senators, is the guy you're looking for. All right, that's it. We got to go. We only get a half an hour, you know. The Dow off 29 points today, about a 10%. The NASDAQ off 34.6 tenths percent. The S&P 500 down 6 points as well, 0.3%. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, George Judson, Suzanne Levy, Andrea Seabrook, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.